It is Thursday, June 29th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, Iraq's military says it has recaptured a landmark mosque. We have a report from the city.
Iraq won, but what have they won? They have won towns and villages, and now Mosul, that so much of it is in ruins, and so many lives have been lost.
Five men are found guilty of the murder of Russian opposition leader Boris Nemtsov, and we preview the new film, Despicable Me 3. It's all ahead. Iraq said Thursday its forces retook control of the destroyed historic mosque in the city of Mosul, where 3 years ago the head of the Islamic State group announced a self-declared caliphate. Militants blew up the 850-year-old Grand al-Nuri Mosque last week. Iraqi forces, backed by airstrikes and ground support from a U.S.-led coalition, are working to oust the last Islamic State fighters from the Old City section of western Mosul and complete their mission to reclaim full control of the city. I spoke with VOA Mideast correspondent Heather Murdoch, who's in Mosul, about the current situation in the Iraqi city.
Well, there are reports out there saying, they use the word liberated, that Mosul has been completely liberated, meaning retaken by Iraqi forces. And those stories are very close to true, and I'm sure there's caveats within the stories, but they are still fighting in Mosul's old city, in just a small area. As of this afternoon, early afternoon, I was there right next to the fighting, and soldiers were saying it was about 500 square meters left of the Islamic State still had control of. Now, it's much later in the day here now, so they could have moved forward, and they were moving forward when I left. But I spoke to some soldiers from Special Forces just a little while ago, and they said while they believe victory is going to happen, maybe tonight, maybe tomorrow, maybe the next day, it's very, very close. It's not quite done yet. In other parts of the city, their tensions are really high because there recently was a resurgence of Islamic State activity, which was believed to be a ploy to try to distract Iraqi forces from the old city to possibly evacuate some of the fighters that are still in there fighting.
What do you mean by a ploy?
Well, basically, 40 or 50 Islamic State militants that appeared to be some kind of sleeper cell just appeared out of an area that nobody lives in, but there's tons of tunnels and hiding places, and there was really no security in that area. So they appear out of nowhere and have a parade, tell people Islamic State is here, kick people out of their houses in two different neighborhoods. I believe we've seen evidence that they killed a couple of people, but most of the people ran away. Now, this was essentially a suicide mission because it was 40 or 50 of them in an area that's completely controlled by the Iraqi military. So even though the military wasn't there at the moment, of course, special forces moved in, then the army moved in, and all of them were killed by Iraqi forces. So it appears to be that they were trying to distract the Iraqi forces from their main battle in the old city so some of their fellow militants in the old city could escape. But soldiers tell me that if this was why they took these actions, they failed, and the old city remains during that time as tightly surrounded as it has been for quite some time.
So basically then, in the old city, the Islamic State fighters are surrounded.
Yes, they are completely surrounded. The area of control is very small. The al-Nuri Mosque, which is not only the symbolic, or was, because it was bombed by militants, it was a symbolic heart of the Islamic State in Iraq. It was also the symbol of Mosul before it was bombed by militants. That mosque is now, soldiers say, they are not in the mosque, but they're right next to it. And that will be, when they do take that mosque, that will be considered kind of the victory day, is what they expected. Although it's kind of a bitter victory because of the bombing of the mosque, Iraqis were really excited to retake that place. And now that it's been destroyed, it's almost symbolic of the rest of the war here because Iraq's won. But what have they won? They have won towns and villages, and now Mosul, that so much of it is in ruins, and so many lives have been lost, and other lives have been ruined. People here call it the disaster, that nothing, they've never seen anything worse in their lives than the entire Islamic State experience.
Heather, what about reports of civilian casualties? How much is known about those figures?
There are a lot of reports out. For example, UNICEF put out a report saying More than 1,000 children have been killed in the past 3 years during the fight with ISIS in Iraq. And the UN put out a report recently saying a few hundred people had been killed by ISIS as they tried to flee. There was also reports of airstrikes and mass casualties in May. And all of these numbers are equal a lot of casualties, but they don't even come close to what is evident on the ground in terms of how many casualties. I mean, even if I just count the amount of people I've spoken to who say they've lost, you know, 5, 10, 20 family members in airstrikes or the battle for their neighborhood, just in the past week, I'm talking about 50 or 60 people that I've heard of that died. And that's just me. I'm just one person, and I'm not talking to everyone. I do a lot of other things, too. And the amount of bodies that we see are overwhelming. I mean, we met a guy the other day who was coming to his house, and it was collapsed. And it was his first time back to the house since the area was cleared from ISIS. And his daughter and his daughter's husband and his daughter's husband's parent and his grandchild were underneath that house. And then around the area, of course, there's also bodies of Islamic State fighters. Civilians are also dying in large numbers from diseases, from bad water, from all of the things that go along with a war that creates extreme poverty. So that's another thing. Besides the airstrikes, the mortars, the Islamic State fighters, people are dying from bad water and lack of food here as well.
VOA Mideast correspondent Heather Murdoch speaking from Mosul, Iraq. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. So, Andrew, what's trending?
Well, President Trump's tweets are getting him in trouble. That's because he tweeted this morning about morning news host Mika Brzezinski, daughter of the former late national security advisor Zbigniew Brzezinski, accusing her and her co-host from this show, Morning Joe, former Republican Congressman Joe Scarborough, of speaking badly of him. And he called Mika Brzezinski low IQ, crazy Mika, and accused her of having a facelift. She responded on social media with a photo of the back of a cereal box that talked about made for small hands. Of course, President Trump has always talked about his hands being big. That was a big moment in the primary campaign. Now, this seems like a silly story, and on some level it is just this back and forth, this silly back and forth. But a lot of people very upset that the president would use this kind of language to talk about someone, particularly a woman, considering the past that President Trump has had with issues of accusations of misogyny and those kind of things. Even House Speaker Paul Ryan asked about it earlier today, called the tweet inappropriate. He said it hurts civil discourse. And a lot of people noting that the president's electronic communications are preserved in the National Archives, so this tweet will literally go down in history. But some consternation and some people very upset with the president using that kind of language on his social media accounts. And another big trending story, 10 years ago today, the late Apple CEO Steve Jobs said, "Today, Apple is going to reinvent the phone," and indeed they did. It was 10 years ago today that the iPhone was released. So hashtag iPhone at 10, lots of people talking about what a cultural icon it has become. Lots of news organizations pulling out of the archives their first reviews of the iPhone way back in 2007. It wasn't that long ago, but No. It seems like it's been such a long time since. It's evolved so many times, and we're seeing a lot of the photos of that evolution. And people saying what an amazing game changer it's been, not just for technology, but how people communicate around the world. And a game changer for Apple. They've sold over a billion of these around the world. It's made them billions and billions of dollars.
Wow, amazing. Well, thanks a lot, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. Here are some of the top news stories trending. A report says Raqqa, Syria is completely encircled by U.S.-backed forces. President Trump mocks a TV anchor's appearance, personalizing his war on the news media. U.S. economic growth is a bit faster than first thought, but is considered still slow. And Australia charges a Vatican official with sex offenses. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
A team of American astronomers made what they describe as the first detection of the orbital motion within a pair of supermassive black holes. The close-circling black holes were found in a galaxy some 750 million light-years away in the Perseus constellation. The astronomers used the National Science Foundation's Very Long Baseline Array to make their detection. Team member Karishma Bansal from the University of New Mexico says the two supermassive black holes will probably merge sometime millions of years from now. The recent detections of gravitational waves were generated by the violent merger of two supermassive black holes. Gravitational waves, which are described as ripples in the fabric of space-time, were predicted more than 100 years ago by Albert Einstein in his theory of general relativity. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, Chinese President Xi Jinping visits Hong Kong as observers question the territory's future. A Moscow court has convicted five Chechen men of the murder of the Russian opposition leader Boris Nemtsov. Nemtsov was an opponent of the Russian government and was especially critical of Moscow's support for Ukrainian separatists. He was shot dead late at night in 2015 as he walked across a bridge near the Kremlin. I spoke with VOA Moscow correspondent Daniel Scharf, who's currently in Washington. I spoke to him about the verdict.
You know, it was welcomed by a lot of the opposition to see the guilty verdicts. At the same time, you know, from the very beginning, there's been a lot of suspicion that those who ordered the killing, those who were really behind it, are not going to face justice. And certainly throughout this trial, we saw that the issue of motive was not addressed, and the attempts to question people who were higher up, who were linked to this, failed miserably. The main suspect, his commander, was supposed to be questioned. Investigators, when they went to Chechnya, knocked on his door and said, oh, he didn't answer. So he was never actually questioned. The top man, of course, that everybody wants to question or wants to see questioned, who's on from the family of Boris Nemtsov and the Russian opposition leaders, you know, they want to see the head of Chechnya, Ramzan Kadyrov, actually face questioning over this. But there was no real attempt to have Kadyrov answer any questions in regard to this trial. He made some statements declaring, you know, that he was not linked to this and saying that, you know, if murder was what these men actually did, then they should face justice. But of course, there are many suspicions about Kadyrov because of previous statements that he's made in the press, including praising the man who was found guilty today for the murder, the actual shooting of Boris Nemtsov, calling him a patriot of Russia.
Now, Kadyrov is close to, I believe, to Russian President Vladimir Putin?
Absolutely. Yeah, no, this is Putin's guy in Chechnya. I mean, they have a very clear relationship. Kadyrov keeps stability in Chechnya. He fights against any militants, any rebels, any terrorists, and maintains an iron grip on that republic. And in return, he gets a lot of support from President Putin, including, you know, to the extent that you hear rumblings from Russia's security services who are not so happy with that situation, especially when Kadyrov makes statements such as threatening to, well, in one case, he had threatened to take action against any federal investigators who cross over into his territory.
VOA Moscow correspondent Daniel Scherf. Chinese President Xi Jinping is visiting Hong Kong for the first time since assuming office in 2013. He's marking the territory's 20th anniversary of its one country, two systems relationship with Beijing. The highlight of the three-day visit will be the inauguration of Carrie Lam as the territory's top official chief executive.
20年来, 中央
In comments at his arrival Thursday, Mr. Xi said he was happy to once again set foot in Hong Kong after 9 years. The Chinese leader said his visit has three purposes: to express his best wishes to the Hong Kong Special Administrative Region, show the central government's backing, and help the region plan its future. Democracy protests are planned during the visit. Hong Kong watcher Felix Patrickeef, the master of Kathleen Lunley College in Adelaide, Australia, tells International Edition's Victor Beatty the noose of a more authoritarian politics is tightening, making it increasingly difficult for residents to exercise basic freedoms. He said Hong Kong's leadership will more and more be doing Beijing's bidding.
The credibility of the chief executive officer is really now far less vibrant or far less impressive than it might have been right at the beginning of that 20-year period. What is actually also occurring is that there is a certain underlying crisis of confidence in terms of something that hasn't actually been mentioned very much, and that is that there is now 30 years left before an uncertain outcome occurs for Hong Kong, and that is that Hong Kong actually should return to the formally to the bosom of China, because it was granted autonomy under the Joint Declaration for 50 years, and the 50-year term ends in 2047. Why that's important is because there are a lot of leases which are currently being taken up, which are about 30 years, which means that in a few years' time, there'll be very, very great discomfort shown on the part of people who want to develop property, for the simple reason that the time span left before 2047 is going to be less and less, and therefore business projections are going to be more difficult to make.
Pro-democracy campaigner Joshua Wong, referring to that 2047 date, says he wants a public vote on sovereignty. Will he get it?
Absolutely not. The Chinese government is making sure that it takes greater and greater control of the place. It's doing so in a very quiet way. Mind you, Carrie Lam has gone on record to say that she's not going to be rocking the boat at all on behalf of Hong Kong, which is a bad sign because she hasn't even been installed, and she's already saying that she will almost certainly be doing the bidding of Beijing, and therefore it's going to become harder and harder to gain any genuine democracy in Hong Kong, and it's going to be much, much harder to enforce an autonomy of a genuine sort as well.
Felix Patrick Heath is the master of Kathleen Lunley College in Adelaide, Australia. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our 5-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, this is Larry London, the host of VOA's Border Crossing. I feature music and interviews with your favorite artists from all around the world. And you can not only listen, but you can interact live with us here in Washington, D.C. Border Crossings comes to you Monday through Friday at 1500 UTC GMT on VOA.
This is International Edition. Gru, Lucy, and the Lovable Minions are back in the third installment of the Despicable Me franchise, which opens in the United States this week. As VOA's David Byrd tells us, the film offers new characters, but many of the same laughs as its predecessors.
Former arch-villain-turned-good guy Gru, voiced by Steve Carell, is back, along with the Minions. But living inside the law is proving tough for Gru. He has to face an old nemesis, Balthazar Brat, voiced by Trey Parker. Brat has a plan to steal the world's largest diamond and take revenge on Hollywood, which canceled his 1980s preteen show when he reached puberty.
It's some kind of monster.
Wait, that's not a monster. That's a man wearing shoulder pads. There's only one supervillain whose fashion sense is quite that dated. Balthazar Brat.
When Gru and his partner and wife Lucy, voiced by Kristen Wiig, bungle a chance to catch Brat, they're fired from the Anti-Villain League. The Minions try to convince Gru to go back to a life of villainy, but he resists. Then the yellow pill-shaped goggle wearers in overalls strike out on their own. When Gru is struggling with an identity crisis, he gets a message from a long-lost twin brother, Dru. The blonde-headed, white-suit-wearing Dru, also voiced by Carell, tells his brother that their family has a long history as bad guys, and he tries to get Gru to teach him the finer points of villainy. At the film's Los Angeles premiere, writers Cinco Paul and Ken Dario said they developed the storyline as a way of expanding the despicable family.
We sort of were wondering, like, how do you expand this family? What's the next step? And once we kind of came onto this brother idea,
it was either a dog or a brother.
And we thought, brother might be more fun. Yeah, you can talk to the brother.
Right, yeah.
Trey Parker says this movie gives him a chance to let his young daughter see his work, something she can't do when he's on the more maturely themed South Park.
And at the time, my daughter was about a year and a half old, and I was like, she could actually watch this. Like, this is something I could do that I could, she wouldn't have to, you know, I wouldn't have to keep her away from. So it was kind of great, and it kind of like all comes down to, this was the moment I was, this was the day I was always thinking about, was being able to take my daughter to a premiere and say, yeah, see, I did that, because I can't do that with South Park, because I'm like, Daddy does this, you can't watch it, but this is what Daddy does, you know.
Steve Carell said that Despicable Me 3 offers families a welcome respite from the more serious news of the day.
It's just positive and fun and silly, and you don't have to think too much about it. It's just a good time, and I think this day and age is kind of nice.
Kristen Wiig echoed Carell's sentiment, saying Despicable Me offers a chance to laugh and enjoy a couple of hours together.
You know what? I feel like it's just a really light, fun movie, and it's silly. And just to like go in the theater and laugh for 2 hours with how crazy the world is right now is a good thing. And parents will enjoy it, kids will enjoy it, so it's a good bonding movie.
The animated Despicable franchise has made nearly $3 billion since the first Despicable Me, including the spin-off movie Minions. Despicable Me 3 is rated PG for action and rude humor. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
And that is our show for today. Please remember to visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
A U.S. airstrike this month killed an al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula senior leader in Yemen's Shabwa Governorate, according to U.S. Central Command. Abu Khattab al-Awlaki, the emir for al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, was killed along with two of his group's associates. Al-Awlaki was responsible for planning and conducting terrorist attacks against civilians. He had significant influence over al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula's terrorist stronghold, had ties and access to the group's other senior leaders, and was implicated in planning and leading efforts to foment instability in southern Yemen. In coordination with the government of Yemen, U.S. forces are conducting sustained counterterrorism operations in Yemen against al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula to degrade the group's ability to hold territory and coordinate external terror attacks. Senior leaders from the terrorist group seek safe haven in places like Shabwa Governorate to plot attacks against the U.S., its interests, and its friends and allies across the world. Al-Awlaki's death removes a trusted and experienced terrorist leader from al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula's ranks. In recent years, the terrorist group has taken advantage of ungoverned spaces in Yemen to plot, direct, and inspire terror attacks against the U.S., its citizens, and allies around the world. Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula and its predecessors attacked the U.S. Embassy in Sana'a in 2008, attempted to down Northwest Airlines 253 on Christmas Day 2009, and conspired to send explosive-laden parcels to Chicago in 2010. Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula has also used its English-language magazine, Inspire, to encourage attacks against the West and has been linked to the 2013 Boston Marathon bombing, 2009 Fort Hood shooting, and other lone wolf attacks in the U.S. and Europe. U.S. forces conducted this strike with the full support of the government of Yemen. Together with its Arab allies, the U.S. will continue to fight terrorist organizations like Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.